Yep.
Thank you, Julia, and thanks for all coming out today. Can you all hear me up the back? Is the sound okay? Thanks. It's tough being a full-time writer. It's like juggling chainsaws and diving on live grenades. You know, I have to wake up every morning without an alarm clock, and straight away I have decisions to make. Will I have breakfast on the south end of the beach or the north end of the beach? And there are 12 cafes to choose from. Will I have the poached eggs or the breakfast panini? And my children are all at school and my wife's at home, so the house is empty. So should we have morning delight or afternoon delight? Okay, so maybe it's not so tough. I'm lucky, you know, I know how fortunate I am. The people who do it tough are the vast majority of writers. You know, I was talking to someone from the Australia Council at the Sydney Writers Festival opening party who said the latest figures were that the average Australian writer made $7,000 a year. And most people don't write just their first book, but their second, their third, and sometimes all their books. They have to do full-time jobs or part-time jobs, and they write in their spare time. And they often write after putting the kids to bed, you know, or after feeding them and reading them bedtime stories and bathing and putting the kids to bed, and then they're already exhausted and they've got 2 hours, and that's where they do their writing. They're the people that do it tough. I didn't quite know how to handle this idea of, and I've spun the topic around a little bit in the sense of, rather than talk about the year ahead, because I never quite know about the year ahead, I was going to talk about the year that's been, which will give you a little snapshot into my life. And I must admit, let me tell you that it's going to inspire some people and it's going to irritate some people, because I'm going to give you a snapshot of a very privileged corner of the publishing world, with which, you know, I inhabit this very privileged corner, and I know how lucky I am. On this day, 12 months ago, I was tooling around the Sydney Writers' Festival with Jennifer Byrne, dropping in on sessions. My wife thinks that Jennifer and I are having an affair. And she and Andrew Denton have discussed this, and they think they should have an affair so they don't feel left out. In the afternoon, I did an ABC broadcast with James Valentine, along with Sheila Hetty and Hannah Kent, and we were discussing the subject, why be a writer? I think Hannah could have answered that question on her own, particularly after the year that she's had. What else happened that day? I was shown the UK paperback jacket for Say You're Sorry, which was due out in about a month's time at that point, or July in the UK. My British publisher was thrilled. It was a special Tesco edition. Because of the demise of independent booksellers in the UK, 97% of all books are now sold through supermarkets and online retailers. And you cannot make a bestseller list unless Tesco or Asda stock you, and they don't stock that many books. I don't know about you, I actually find that desperately sad. I'm very fortunate that they stocked my book. You know, it did mean that when I went to the UK in July to launch Say You're Sorry, without a doubt the most important meeting, even though I did events, you know, through the UK for the launch, the most important meeting I had was a lunch with the Tesco buyer, who is without doubt the most powerful person in publishing now in the United Kingdom, which again, as I say, I find sad. It's the reality of the situation, but I find that sad. I also, this time last year, approved the jacket of a book called If I Tell You, I'll Have to Kill You. It's a book I edited. It's a series of essays by 20 of Australia's crime writers, leading crime writers, talking about why they love the genre, how they got published, how they write what they write. And it's, for those people interested in writing, it's not, whether it be crime fiction or otherwise, it is a really interesting book full of lots of anecdotes about the process and advice about the process, as well as, every sort of element of the publishing process, I suppose. And that was something that was done with all the funding going towards the Australian Crime Writers Association and the Ned Kelly Awards. On May 22nd, I received an email from my German publisher saying that the German language edition of Bombproof had sold 50,000 copies in the first 4 weeks. And I thought that was pretty impressive. But say you're sorry, Germany has been in the top 10 since last September. I refer to my home in Avalon as the house that the Germans have bought. And like Basil Fawlty, I never mention the war. It is Germany is my biggest market. I don't quite understand why or how that's happened. But this is one of the strange things that happen when you're published and lucky enough to be published internationally. Tomorrow night, I go to the Australian Book Industry Association Awards, which are on tomorrow night. I'm shortlisted in the general fiction category for Watching You. I won't win. The Rosie Project will win. I would vote for the Rosie Project. Losing won't be that hard. Listening to Tony Abbott make the after dinner speech will be much more difficult. In June, I had new author photos taken. They were taken by Tony Mott, the legendary music photographer who has photographed everyone from the Rolling Stones and the Beatles through to One Direction. There's nothing glamorous about having new author photos taken, not when you're a crime writer, because invariably they take you into some urine-soaked stormwater drain or railway underpass, or in front of some graffiti-stained wall, and that's where you get photographed. You don't need a stylist, you need a shower. By the end of June, things were ramping up for the launch of Watching You in the UK. As I said, I flew over there and I attended, amongst the many events I did, I attended the Harrogate Crime Writing Festival, which is an amazing event. I mean, some of the writers were there, Rian Rankin, Val McDermott, P.D. James, Lee Child, Kate Atkinson, Charlaine Harris. I mean, it's an astonishing event. It takes place in the old Swan Hotel in Harrogate, which is famous because it is where Agatha Christie reappeared after her mysterious 11-day vanishing act in 1926, which is still a mystery as to why, what happened during that 11 days. It did captivate the nation when she did disappear because she was incredibly famous in her own lifetime. And Conan Doyle and Dorothy Sayers and other writers joined the search for her. You know, and but she turned up in the ballroom of the old Swan Hotel when a member of the band recognised her because she'd signed in under an assumed name. So it's a very fitting place to have a crime writing festival, the Old Swan. If you ever get a chance to go there, it is truly a remarkable festival as well. That weekend, for some reason, my publishers thought it was a really good idea prior to that weekend to hold a competition among readers to write a review of my new book. And the winner would get a weekend pass to Harrogate and to have dinner with me. My children, my three teenage daughters, thought this was hilarious, the idea that someone would enter a competition to have dinner with me. I was actually so nervous about this that I was accompanied by two publicists and an editor because they were slightly worried that the fan or the reader that came along might be just too excited. I must admit, I did have someone in a signing queue at Harrogate faint, you know, which I thought was, you know, she just was, I just sort of said hello and she just couldn't get the words out. She was so excited. And she fainted. It doesn't often happen, I can tell you. anyway, the fan turned out to be a wonderful lady. She was a nuclear physicist, you know, and a crime fiction fan and crime fiction writer. And she came along with a 14-year-old daughter. The only downside of being at Harrogate that year was it coincided with the Lord's Test match. And that's the match that Australia got a complete and utter flogging in. And I was the only Australian among 15,000 festival goers, and they were all incredibly polite because they reminded me of the score every 5 minutes. I flew back to Australia. I had a few days to recover before the Byron Bay Writers Festival, if I Tell You I'll Have to Kill You was launched, and then a few weeks later, Watching You was launched in Australia. I began the day at Channel 9. In makeup, preparing to be interviewed by David Campbell and Sarah Cummings, who was standing in for Sonia Kruger on the morning show. And I shared the couch with Tara Moss. It was a complete disaster. They ran late interviewing Charlotte Dawson about fashion or Hollywood or celebrity babies. And by the time they ushered Tara and I onto the couch, we had precisely 90 seconds to talk about our new books. Which neither of them had read, and they were not interested either. So all I remember is basically sitting there with a frozen smile and saying secretly under my breath, I'm going to kill my publicist. Morning radio presenters. I mean, this is one of the perils of promoting books. You don't work with children or dogs or on morning TV. Later that day, I was interviewed by Michael Cathcart on Radio National and Richard Glover on Drive, and I felt more like a grown-up. It is one of those things when you're doing publicity and you sort of know when the first question you get asked by some incredibly bubbly, upbeat radio presenter is, so tell us what your book's about. And the next question is, so how long did it take you to write? And I always feel like adding, I'm sorry there aren't any pictures. The whirlwind sort of continued. Before I go on, I just want to reassure you, during all this time, I am writing. I wrote this morning, I got up at 5 o'clock this morning and wrote. I'll go home tonight and I will write. I've written 10 books in 10 years, which might seem prolific, but as I said, I have the enormous good fortune to be able to do this full time. And not only that, I have a wonderful wife who pretty much does everything and allows me to write full time. And if I want to work 16 hours a day, 7 days a week, she's happy to let me do that. Even while sort of promoting Watching You, obviously, I was halfway through writing a book called Life or Death, which will be published at the end of July this year. And early next year in America. And I started researching Life or Death the previous September when I spent 3 weeks in Arizona, Texas and Arkansas looking at locations. This included a week in a tiny hotel in a town of Jasper in Newton County in the Ozark Mountains. A town that had only one bar and one restaurant, and it was like something out of an Elmore Leonard short story. And I swear to God, the only thing missing was a blind kid playing a banjo. Small-town American hospitality that people talk about, it doesn't exist in places like Jasper because they get so few visitors. And I was treated with suspicion from the first time I arrived. I ate alone for 7 days. There was a sign, I never forget, I mean, everyone carried guns. I mean, the waitress carried a sidearm. And there was a sign on the door of the restaurant which said there was a concealed handgun carrying course being run by the Arkansas Sheriff's Wives Association. And I thought, oh, I can meet some people. And so I went along to the concealed handgun course and fired a gun for the first time in my life. And I'll never forget, I was with two grandmothers who were talking about buying, and they were on the course, and they were talking about buying guns, and one of them, whose hair was the colour of sort of spitting tobacco, she was telling a friend that she was arguing with her husband about buying an automatic pistol because the husband was fearful that if they got into an argument, he might get shot. And she said to her friend, I told him I'd only shoot him in the leg. And day three of my time in Jasper, still not having talked to anyone apart from these two grandmothers and the instructor at the gun course, I got visited by the local sheriff. Obviously, I'd been walking through town taking photographs, and he decided to pay me a visit. And I explained to him, he said to me, his name was Sheriff Keith Slape, and he turned up, and he said, you've been taking photographs of the bank. And I said, I've been taking photographs of everything. And he said, I said, is there a law against that? And he said, there's a law against being a smartass. And I explained that I was a writer and researching a book, and he wanted to know what the book was about. And I said that, well, it's about a guy who serves a long prison sentence and escapes the day before he's due to be released. And he said, well, that would make him dumber than shit on a biscuit. Exactly. he did... And I did actually need to ask him a few questions, and I started asking questions about being a sheriff in a small town. And he said, "Is there a sheriff in your story?" And I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "Is he a good guy?" And I said, "Oh, no, oh," I said, "Yeah, he's the hero." As it turned out, I didn't set my story in Jasper. I decided to set it in Texas. So it was the longest, worst week of my life and wasted as well. I got back in time to go to the Ned Kelly Awards in Brisbane, and then I continued to tour throughout sort of New South Wales and events in New South Wales country, and then off to Western Australia. And you know, it's interesting. I do a lot of touring, and people sort of, you know, and the reason is, you know, I'm invited, which I'm very flattered by. I feel as though I owe my publishers. I mean, I work to advances, and I'm very fortunate that they pay me quite large advances, and I feel as though if they're going to get their money back, it's like investing in someone. If they're going to get that money back, you know, the book has to be successful. So I do a lot of work. I do a lot of events, far beyond what I'm contractually committed to doing. And the other reason is, you know, I spend a year writing and almost in complete isolation. You know, I used to work in what my children refer to as Dad's Pit of Despair, which is my basement office. We've since moved into the house that the Germans have bought, and I now work in the cabana of cruelty. But I love getting out and meeting readers and meeting... it's that one time of the year where I feel as though I can also just talk books to people, not just my own book, but I can talk about other things I've been reading, and I love meeting other writers. My year finished with a trip to the Body in the Garden Festival in Adelaide, the inaugural Body in the Garden. It's a very weird festival that combined gardening writers and crime writers. Not just in the same festival, but on the same panels. Shane Maloney and I did a panel with two gardening writers, and the subject was landscape. Now, I did put a point out that Shane pointed out he killed 19 people, and I've killed 26 at last count. But really, you know, we try not to disturb the garden too much. And I basically complained to them about the demise of the Australian cricket team at that point. I put down completely to these gardening people that keep insisting on, you know, turning backyard cricket pitches into pagodas and, you know, fountains and things. Something happened in the US. Very exciting, but again, it's a little snapshot of it. As I said, I live in a very privileged part of this publishing world. My US publishers decided... to discount the paperback edition of Say You're Sorry down from $12 down to $2.99 for a single day, for a sort of Amazon daily deal. And it sold 16,000 copies in that day, and even when it went back up to its full price on Amazon, it went on to sell 35,000 copies in the week. Which put me at number 8 on the New York Times bestseller list, which they were thrilled about because they could now call me a New York Times best-selling author. But what I found quite strange about all this was, I was thrilled as well, but was the amount of feedback I got from, you know, through the Amazon reviews that flooded in from all these thousands of people. And so many of them began their review with a statement, "I wouldn't normally have spent as much as $2.99 on a book, but I decided to take a risk." 7 people gave me 1-star reviews on account of the fact they missed out on the discount and decided to give me 1-star because they had to pay $11.99 for the book. And I don't know about you, that frightens me. That truly does frighten me. And I know that later in the day we're going to have panels and we'll be talking about this whole sort of issue with self-publishing and pricing and all sorts of other things. Just to remind you again that, you know, through all of this time I was writing Life or Death. I delivered it on Christmas Eve. My agents and editors read it over the break. Nobody reads my books until they're finished. It's not like they're reading a first draft. They're reading draft 7. My wife is my first designated reader. She banishes me from the bedroom because I will literally lie beside her watching her lips move, seeing if she smiles at the right time. And eventually, so she banishes me. So I look through a crack in the door. And then she banishes me from that floor of the house. And so I have to go and sit in the cabana of cruelty. But I only ever print out sort of 50 pages at a time. So she has to come. She has to come looking for me. And you sort of, you know, and I just, now, I mean, I've lived for a year with this story, or in the case of Life or Death, the idea for 10 years. And I just want her to tell me all the time, what did you think of that bit? What did you think of that bit? Did you like that? Did you not? You know, and I love it, you know, when she comes screaming out, and she, you know, because she's read something that something terrible's happened to someone she's grown to love, and she thumps me in the chest and says, bring them back, you bastard. I know you can. Bring them back. And if, you know, she reads it and then it goes out to everyone. And if I have not heard back within, and this again is because I live in a fairy tale land when it comes to publishing. If I haven't heard back within a week from my editors, I will by that point be so cranky and so short tempered that my wife will contact my agent and my publishers and say that she's divorcing me unless they get back to me. And so they get back to me. It's a very different sort of book, Life or Death. I was quite worried it's set in the deep south. It's not set in my usual sort of locations and with a whole new cast of characters. But I'll give you an idea of, as much as this is a privileged place, you know, there is a huge buggeration factor that comes with, you know, some of the things I have to do. In February, I flew to America for a pre-launch of Watching You. I did a bookseller event in LA, which went swimmingly, and did some media, and I had a meeting with the executive producer, Ridley Scott's film company, who wanted to discuss optioning one of my books. All great. Then I went to the airport to fly to New York, where a dinner had been arranged, a lunch and then a dinner involving journalists from everyone from CNN to Letterman to USA Today to Good Morning America. And I got to LAX, and it's sort of 9 o'clock in the morning, and that was just when the superstorm was sweeping across the eastern seaboard. I spent 18 hours waiting at LAX before I could fly into New York. And I finally caught the flight at midnight that night, and we got within an hour of JFK. And I knew at that point, I thought, there's no way we're getting in, because there'd been no plane. 16 inches of snow had been dumped on New York, and no plane had sort of landed or taken off in 12 hours. And we were warned, you know, I said, we're not going to get in, folks. But then the pilot announced, they've allowed us to try. We're going to be the first flight to land since it was closed. So basically, it was like Jumbo's on ice, really, in that landing. And I arrived, and we arrived safely. But there's no way I could get a taxi from the airport, because there were no taxis at the airport. They had to send a four-wheel drive with chains to get me into the city. My lunch with all those wonderfully, you know, important people had long ago been cancelled. My cocktail party that night had been cancelled. I couldn't stay in America for things to be rescheduled. I had a Wheeler Centre event in Melbourne, basically within hours of me arriving back in Australia. So I had to basically get on a plane the next morning. The only thing I managed to do was to fight my way through 8 inches of slush to get to the Doc Martens store to buy Doc Martens for my teenage daughters. And my own shoes had been so ruined by that point, I had to buy a pair for myself. I got on a plane to fly back, and a plastic bag flew, or someone thought they saw a plastic bag fly into the engine. And so that was 6 hours delayed, and a long story, missed connections, had to buy new flights, you know. And I should have pointed out to this something that I didn't mention at the beginning of this. I'm paying for this. You know, there's always this assumption that publishers are picking up the tab, particularly with the way publishing is at the moment, and particularly in America. They're expecting the writers to pay for their own tours. So I'm paying for all of these flights and new flights, because when I thought I was going to miss the connection, because I was told I was going to miss it, I got my wife to book me a flight to Brisbane that left LA. And, of course, they held the flight to Sydney. And because I got to that flight having run through the terminal. They said, "Sir, you're no longer booked on this flight." They actually charged me for the two flights because, you know, I couldn't say that I'd missed it because of them. You know, and then, you know, I've got to tell you the rest of the story because it gets sort of, you know, I know this is sort of first world problems, but, you know, when I finally got into Brisbane Airport, you know, without a bag, of course, because my bag didn't make that flight, there was a poor young American student. The same thing had happened. She was flying into Wollongong, supposed to go to Wollongong University, and people were supposed to be picking her up from Sydney. And she turned up in Brisbane without a bag, and her mobile phone didn't work, and she was crying by the luggage carousel because she had no way to call anyone, and she was, you know, 18 years old. She'd never been out of America before. So I said, "Don't worry," and I got on my phone, and I rang Wollongong Accommodation Services, and I said, "Listen, your student, she's in Brisbane. She's going to be on the next domestic flight to Sydney." You know, and I got all the details, but I'm halfway through this conversation and a customs officer comes up to me and says, "Sir, turn off your phone." And I said, "I'm just trying to help this. I'm nearly finished this phone call. Sir, turn off your phone." And I'm trying to explain to him while I'm on this short story. I got arrested and held for 2 hours for failing to obey a customs officer's request. And my phone was confiscated, which I then had to pay a lot of money to have it couriered down to the Wheeler Centre in Melbourne. And those Doc Martens, by the way, were the most expensive Doc Martens ever purchased. I did get my Doc Martens back. Every day sort of brings something new to what I do. You know, as I said, I write every day. But I feel very privileged, you know. I can tell you, 2 days ago, a DVD arrived by courier from a German film company, the same German film company that co-produced The Bridge and The Killing, and also the Jack Irish co-produced production here with the ABC. And it was my first book. It has been made into a film in Germany, and they were sending it to me with subtitles in the hope that I liked it enough that I would give them permission to make 5 more. You know, again, enormously, to sit there and watch something, you know, that, yeah, a book that I've written turned and put on screen, you know, and done so beautifully was an enormous privilege. Every week a new edition is published, you know, somewhere in the world. I'm translated now into 22 languages, you know, and I love getting the copies, you know, and I always make sure I get a few, you know, and I keep one and I donate another to the library here because, you know, I want... You know, they're always looking for foreign editions because people come to this country and they can't, English isn't their first language, and they should be able to pick up a book and read something that reminds them of home. Every day I get loads and loads of emails from people, and some of them, and I'm going to read you just a couple here. These are all just in May. And some of them are incredibly moving. "Dear Mr. Robotham, I'm a retired librarian, 76 years old, and I've been a high school dropout, amateur boxer, and occasional poet. Just to provide some info on who's writing to you. When I was a child, I sometimes became so engrossed in a book that I forgot where I was, and I've been unsuccessfully trying to duplicate that experience for many years. Now I have. Although I don't particularly like mysteries, police procedurals and such, something about watching you caused me to pick it up and start reading. And wow, once again I had that old experience of abandon. As soon as I finished that one, I immediately went to read Bleed For Me. And my wife, who's also a fanatic reader, is reading all of your books. On a more personal note, I've been tentatively diagnosed with Parkinson's, and my main character has Parkinson's in many of these books. And I find your depiction of the disease is spot on. Even if I didn't have this connection, I would have always been attracted to the flawed protagonist. In a strange way, reading your books makes me want to write more and better poetry. Thank you for that and for bringing such bliss to my reading habit. With admiration, Bob Friedman." You know, another letter was from someone who said she was 41 years old and hated reading. She had not read a book since she left home, but her company decided to have a book club meeting, set up a book club, and she laughed at them. She said, "You'll never get me to read a book." And finally they said, "Just take this one home and read 2 chapters, or 1 chapter even." She said, "Wow, I couldn't stop reading, and I didn't want to stop reading. I loved it. It was the first book I'd willingly read and finished without worrying what page I was and how many I had left. Thank you. Oh, did I mention that I finished it in less than a week and I'm a mother of four boys, all of them under the age of 10? I couldn't wait till I was asleep, till they were asleep, and was able to pick it up and start reading it again. And then you get, for every positive one, you get the sort of... I'm reading The Suspect. This is from Carol Ann Potter, and I have many ladies. I'm reading The Suspect and liking it very much. Not far into it, but you... You take a nasty dig at George W. Bush. I can tell you the line. It's on page 29. I refer to George W. Bush. My character says something doesn't look quite right. It's like seeing Bill Gates in board shorts or George W. Bush in the White House. That is the line. And I cannot tell you how much hate mail I've received. She said, this nasty dig at George W. Bush. I happen to be a Republican and I'm wondering why you would be so short-sighted as to offend half the population of the US. I was looking forward to your other books and I'm now reconsidering. You know, if I do get yours, I'll probably just borrow them from the library. I responded to Carol. I said, Carol, it's one line spoken by one character in a book of 100,000 words. There is nothing else in the book that is in any way political. This line has caused me so much grief. I have had emails calling me a communist, homosexual, a Muslim. You know, there have been death threats. I was actually attacked by a guy in Madison, Wisconsin, over that line. I did happen to say that he could find something in the children's section next time, but... really, he overreacted. And I said to her, isn't it strange how I can write about terrible crimes involving innocent people and nobody complains, but I write one line about a politician and some people think I deserve to be shot? You know, I'll end this sort of on one more there. This again, where you can't quite win. You know, this was from a young reader. I think she says how old she is. I started reading your book, Bleed For Me, about a day or two ago, and over the course of reading it, I've seen some pretty shitty things being said. But when I was reading the beginning of chapter 20, which I will quote, I honestly yelled out loud at your fucking misogyny. Charlie, a young teenage girl, has a football game for a district team. Watching teenage girls play a competitive team sport is completely different from watching boys. There is no diving, feigning injury, flying elbows or cynical fouls. Body contact tends to be completely accidental and should... one of the girls get injured, 21 players will stand around asking, are you okay? Now, I've seen this countless times when my daughters have played football. This is the way I see them play. This girl took exception, this letter writer. And she said to me, now I realise you are writing a character, but this man is a psychologist, someone who understands people and the way people work and the way people truly are. And the passage I just quoted was sexist and misogynistic and terrible, all in one. You're suggesting females are more fragile, less aggressive, and not able to sweat or get dirty. You're even suggesting that we don't like hard work. Really? Was I suggesting that? You're lessening us to people with minds on boys and lust, people who don't care for academics, which is absolutely fucking horrible, and I cannot believe you'd write something like this. I am a 16-year-old girl who picked up your book from my local library, and I'm appalled at what I've read. I won't be reading any more of your books anytime soon, and I definitely won't be finishing this book. Get your fucking head out of your ass and stop being a misogynistic prick. Have a nice evening and fuck you. Amanda. Oh well, what more is there to say? You will hear people tell you that writing is hard. That's rubbish. Boxing is hard, looking after a disabled child is hard, being a battered wife is hard. Yes, there are days when writing is like walking through mud, and there are other days when the words flow freely and you dare to believe that you might just have cracked it and discovered the secret. There are moments of great joy and there are moments when you as a writer will be mortified. But even when the latter occur, I realise how lucky I am, because I can do what I love and I can do what I've dreamed of doing since I was 12 years old. And whenever things are going well, or aren't going well, I remind myself of a story that I once heard the poet Simon Armitage tell. He walked along a street and he noticed a copy of his wonderful book of poetry, a hardback copy, in a charity dump bin. and there was a sticker on the front saying, signed by the author. And his heart sank a little. So he picked it up and he opened the front cover, and yes, indeed, there was his signature. And written above it in his handwriting was the message, to Mum and Dad. Yeah, that's a bad day. Ladies and gentlemen, I am enormously privileged to introduce Emo McBride to today, because we're going to talk publishing and our paths to publishing, and hers is very different to mine. Her book is absolutely astonishing, A Girl is a Half-Formed Thing. It's brave, it's dramatic, it's unusual, but I'm not going to say anything more until she's on the stage. Can you please welcome Emo McBride?